originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Happy to have you with us throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 206, and everybody tuning in worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net. It is a pleasure to welcome you to the program again this evening. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, with you in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studio. And excited for tonight's special guest. Jude, you remember a few weeks back, you had the privilege of talking with your good friend Pete Miller, who recorded his first Breeders' Cup victory at Del Mar a few weeks ago. And he didn't do it once. He did it twice. And that was such an enjoyable show.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to do. And Pete and I go back a long ways. He was an assistant for me. And I trained for his stepfather, actually. So that was a lot of fun. But the guy we've got on today, he also won his first Breeders' Cup race. And although we're not personal friends, I've had a lot of respect for him over the years, as some of my friends have worked for him. And I was very pleased that a guy that works that hard got his first victory.
Very well said. I have followed our special guest's career for a very, very long time growing up in the Northeast. He is always among the top trainers at the tracks that he trains at. And he finally broke through with that first Breeders' Cup victory here in 2017. He is a 63-year-old native of New Jersey who first joined us on this Trainer Talk show back in 2014. Now, at that time, he had trained countless graded stakes winners, but as we just told you, he had yet to saddle a Breeders' Cup winner. That all changed when New York bred Bar of Gold crossed the finish line first in this year's Filly and Mare Sprint at Del Mar. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome Breeders' Cup winning trainer John Kimmel back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here tonight. John, welcome, my friend.
Thanks, guys. It was quite a lead-in.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that massive win. And I'm sure that even though you're a month removed from that victory now, you're probably still on cloud nine in a lot of respects.
It's funny. You knock on the door and nobody really knows, but you win one of those and people don't forget, especially one that rings the bell there with a $135 mutual. And you find out all the guys, I should have bet kind of stories. But anyway, it was a wonderful day. My first time actually even running a horse at Del Mar. And, it was a really great experience.
Now your favorite track, huh?
Yeah, I said, I have so much family out there, and my son came out, and he actually was there for the race. So the only thing, they kind of shuffled us out of the paddock after we saddled the horse to the viewing area, and we were like, well, where are the machines? So we didn't know where they were taking us. Basically, they herded us right to the wire, and we watched the race on the rail, which is usually not, for me, the greatest place to watch a race. And I had to watch the race on the monitor. That was the infield monitor. And at that point, I wasn't really sure whether we got up or didn't get up. But, I turned around and a couple guys said, you won. And I was like, you did? it was from there, this moment of just being a little unreal that, one that went off at 66-1 actually ran her career race, because she's always been knocking on the door and never let in. And she seemed to have gotten this accolade that she's okay against New York breds, but in open company, she just wasn't up to the task. And we tried grass, and she did win a New York race on the grass, but lost to some pretty good competition in her grass races. And even her races on the synthetic were very good, too. She's an extremely versatile filly.
Yeah, very versatile, and now a Breeders' Cup winner. And you mentioned the hefty win price of 66-1. Did you have a couple of bucks on her, John?
No, I didn't have a dime, which was, you know, unfortunate.
yeah, because then you got to buy dinner and everything.
You know, and then my other son said, you got my 20 down. So it ended up costing me money. He says, well, I expected you to bet, you know, even if I lost, I was never going to get paid. But, you know, that's what you get when you have siblings and young kids that, want to bet. But, the guys that did bet, I had a couple of owners that had them across the board, a couple that had it in some of the exotic wagers. And, you know, they were, I actually, my phone blew up. I had well over 200 text messages within the next 3 hours. It was crazy.
Yeah, pretty spectacular. And you mentioned you didn't know if she got up or not, and it was pretty exciting when you found out that she actually did. The margin of victory was only a nose, and I guess as Tom Durkin might describe it, a heart-pounding stretch battle as she ran down Amiz Mesa. Tell me about watching that. You're watching on the television monitor.
Well, yeah,
what's it
like? I was watching it, and I was like looking over somebody's shoulder on the rail up at the monitor, and I had it picked out from the start to finish. And you know, if you watched her, the one thing I noticed was the early quarter, 21 and change. And then Mike Smith kind of asked Unique Bella to move from that point. She knocked out a 44 and change. I said, wow, that's a very fast fraction. I didn't see my courses that would carry that kind of speed. And I could see that Irad, who's had a great relationship with this filly since last summer, he was just kind of finding a spot for the filly, and he kind of let her find a rhythm, and he found a beautiful seam just outside the 3/8 pole. And when he asked her, I mean, she made a super great run up the inside, found a nice seam moving forward, and had her perfectly positioned on the outside. And if she had enough horse, you know, he was maybe going to get there, but that was always the big question, you know, are they going to get there?
Yeah, she was kind of telegraphing herself all week long. I mean, she looked so great in the morning's training. We've talked about this before, but she just couldn't have been doing any better, I didn't think, at Del Mar. She looked beautiful all week long.
It's funny that you say that. We shipped her out. We didn't make the decision, actually, guys, till Saturday, the week before. And we had reserved a spot on a plane to fly out on Sunday morning. So Irad came over, that's Irad Ortiz, came over, worked the filly on Saturday morning, and she was, you know, as good as I've ever seen her. She went 47 and change out in 59 and change out in 12 and 4 on the training track here at Belmont. And, I mean, just looked like she was so in hand. It was a very pleasing performance, both visually and on the clock. So we came back here. I called Mr. Broman. I said, you know, she's going to be a long price, but I can't tell you she's not doing well. If you want to go and you already have a horse in the race with Highway Star, who's already beaten this filly twice, this filly is good to go. So he says, okay, let's go. And that was the moment where we decided. So we ship her out the next morning. They don't have any room for the groom, so I got to fly him out on a commercial flight. He gets out there, and a woman who's worked for me for many years in my Fair Hill division and rode races for me, Tracy Brown Price, was out there with John Thompson's Thomas's horse in the juvenile turf race. So I asked her if she wanted to get on the horse, and she had worked for me for a dozen years. And every day I'd call her because I didn't get out there until Wednesday. She said, this filly, she feels fantastic. She loves this racetrack, and she just had adjective after adjective describing, you know, how comfortable the filly was. And I got out there, watched her train on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday morning, and, you know, she just looked so comfortable. And one of the things that was the final note in why we went is that Irad was available. I don't think I would have gone if Irad wasn't open in the race. He's gotten a great confidence in this filly. And one of the things you might have noticed that he was doing that didn't get done in the Keeneland race was that when he warms her up with the pony and then the last 4 minutes, 5 minutes prior to post, he leaves the pony and lets her jog and kind of get in a really nice rhythm. She's such a class act. She's not pulling hard, but I think Gabby Gaudette even made comment on national TV that, boy, Bargo looks super warming up. Now, to go back to the race before in the Spinster, Irad couldn't go down there. I said to Saez, Luis Saez, I said, did you talk to Irad? I want to make sure that you do the same thing, warm her up with the pony, then leave the pony. It was a sea of mud out there. I wanted her to get used to it and have her jog and stretch her legs right up to the time you get loaded because it seems to help her with the break. And the guy walked to the post for 5 minutes with the pony, never even, moved. So those are one of the things as trainers, you scratch your head and go, does he not understand English? Boy, what is the story here? And she broke bad, got stuck wide, and the race was just like a put-a-line-through-it race. When she'd been 5 for 6 on off-racetrack, she was bet down to 3-2 favorite in a $500,000 grade one race. But she came back fine, and that's a little asterisk to the whole story that makes you scratch your head, coming off a race like that and then throw the performance she did out in Del Mar.
Yeah, I'm laughing, John, because we hear so often trainers will tell us that you can do everything right, you can get the horse ready to run, but then once you give a leg up to the jockey, things are out of your hands, and sometimes that works out in your favor, and sometimes, as you just described, sometimes it doesn't.
That's so true. It's very frustrating at times. It can happen in grade one races, and it can happen in any other type of race. Even the top riders in the world, they're all suspect to having bad days and bad decisions. And, I think having Irad on there gave me some confidence that he knows her well enough. He's probably breezed her maybe 8 or 10 times as well as have ridden her, that I really had a lot of confidence that he was going to do the best he could for her in the race. And whether that was going to be a winning one, nobody knew for sure, because it sure looked like a very tough race on paper to me. It looked very tough, right? 1 through 14, you could make the case for probably 10 horses in the race that all had legitimate chances in that race.
Another thing, too, that trainers have to worry about sometimes when you're running one that's 65-1, and you have a jockey like Irad Ortiz aboard, is he really going to be serious about this race? Does he really think this filly has a chance? And that you kind of took that out of the equation because of the fact that he does have confidence in her, and regardless of what the board was saying, he thought she could win, and that's a huge factor, I think.
Yeah, he does. He loved this filly from the first time he ever worked her. He worked her on the Oklahoma track at Saratoga for the first time this summer. And when he got off her, I said, what did you think? He said, that's the best feeling horse I've breezed all summer long, quote unquote. And I get on a lot of horses for a lot of top outfits, including Chad Brown and Karen McLaughlin and all those big name trainers that have plenty of quality horses. And he said, she's the best feeling horse I've breezed all summer long.
Wow.
Period.
So she's been going good since Saratoga, huh?
Yeah. I mean, she's, these kind of horses are so hard to come by. She's sound. She's classy. She doesn't bleed. She shows up. She can run versatile surface from synthetic to dirt to grass. I mean, how often you have a horse that can kind of do everything, and she can run from distances from 3/4 to a mile and a 16th. Actually, her best buyer number was a mile and a 16th race in the Empire Distaff a year ago, where she ran a 109 buyer number and was eased up the last 50 yards. Yeah, she's quite the racehorse that, to me, if I was starting a broodmare band, I'd pin her as being one of my selections, because she basically had it all and could do it all.
Visiting with trainer John Kimmel here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, as I was thinking about this particular victory and what it must have meant to you after spending your entire life in this business and growing up with your dad who was so involved in this business. You know, it made me think about how unpredictable this game really is. You've been predominantly New York, East Coast based for your entire career, but your first Breeders' Cup win comes some 2,700 miles west of New York in Del Mar. Go figure.
Yeah, exactly. Go figure. You know, I don't know how to add anything to that other than she certainly seemed to enjoy the surface where many of the horses on that particular day seemed to have some trouble with it. Some of the legitimate chalk horses were, you know, running up to their standards. And hold on one second. Yeah, I'm sorry. Just had some people asking me some questions.
Hey, anyway, you're a rock star now, John. You're going to get a lot of questions.
But anyway, getting back to Del Mar, they say I have a sister that lives out there. I have a son and a granddaughter, a two-year-old granddaughter, and you know, I really like California. And if I ever thought that there would be a change that I would make, I would consider going out there. I'm not a big fan of some of the winter racing, and I don't know. I really like the climate and all the things that California has to provide, except the traffic.
Yeah, the traffic's a bear.
I was glad to hear you tell me when I called you to ask you to join us on the show, John, that when you went to California for the Thanksgiving holiday and finally took a little bit of a break this year, that you got a chance to spend time with your sons and with your sister. And your sons are interesting. They have different careers than what you decided to pursue, but they're both doing very, very well. Tell me about them.
Well, my oldest boy, he graduated high school on the New Jersey. He was a Florida bred, and when we moved back to New Jersey after my mom passed away, he became a very elite surfer, and he actually won the Eastern Surfing Championships in Melbourne, Florida, at the end of his high school career. So this kid, he said, well, I want to be a professional surfer. And he got a bunch of sponsors, and off he went to California, and where the surf is supposedly one of the best places in the country, and started surfing around the world and surf videos. And I said, oh, boy, here's this kid. He's going to be like, yeah, dude, really good wave. You know? So I was kind of concerned. He did that for about 4 years, and you know, he was making 35 or 50,000 from his sponsors, but it really wasn't you know, a lifestyle that was going to provide the basically a lifestyle of plenty. So he went back to school in Santa Monica, got 60 hours in good standing, transferred to UCLA, and graduated from UCLA. And got a job in the banking business just when the banks crashed. He had a two-year internship, and they said, look, we're not giving you the program you were wanting. You can leave. He says, okay, bye. So he left, and what do you think he did? He went on a surf trip to Indonesia. So he's surfing in Indonesia, and he runs into these corporate young executives that are on this surf trip that have a big company based in Chicago that trades currency with an office in Orange County. And they go, hey, you're a really cool kid. Why don't you come interview with us? Can you believe this? In Indonesia. So he basically went to work for this currency trading company in Orange County. And at the same time, he went to work. He got a master's in business going on weekends and nights. And after he graduated on the three-year program, he got a job working for a guy named Jeff Gundlach, Double Line Capital, which is a huge asset management company based in L.A. that has, I guess they're over $100 billion in assets, $100 billion.
Wow.
And they're huge, and he's their lead analyst, and he's killing it. He lives in Topanga Canyon, and he surfs when he can, and they have a little two-year-old granddaughter that's as cute as could be. She gave me a cold, though. But, you know, But anyway, they got a great little lifestyle going there. So that's one end of the spectrum. Son number two is 3 years younger. He's a 32-year-old musician who has a band named the Jack Moves, and it's a throwback. They sing soul. He's like the white Marvin Gaye type of falsetto voice, and he toured with a guy named Ben Harper, and he did well over 30 shows opening. The name of the band, the Jack Moves, opened for Ben Harper in the Northwest out there, and then he did 26 shows in Europe. And my girlfriend and I flew over to Paris, and he played at one show in Paris that we saw, and then another one, in Strasbourg. And it was a blast. The stadium in Paris was like 16,000 people, though. So to see your son playing in front of that many people, and it was quite exciting. And he also came out when Ben Harper was on stage with his band and did a song that David Bowie was known for, Under Pressure. You know the song?
Sure.
Yeah, so he came out and did this singing and Under Pressure, and it was really kind of emotional for me to kind of watch him in this kind of venue. And now he's out in California with his manager working on the next album. So, you know, he's a pauper until he finds some success. But, you know, he's committed to doing it, and he's working real hard. And I think they're trying to get this album completed by next year.
Well, that's great. He's doing what he loves, and it sounds like both your sons are really cool guys.
Yeah, he's cool. And, you know, I grew up in Jersey and very close with Patty Scalfa. If you know the name, it's Bruce's Springsteen's wife. And so those guys used to hang around. And actually, one day we went down to hang out with them at their farm in Colts Neck, and Bruce and Patty both listened to his album. And then they took him into the recording studio and showed him his recording studio that he's got in the farm. And, you know, they gave him some advice. And I said, it's pretty cool to have a guy like Bruce and Patty sit down and listen to your whole album. I said, that doesn't happen too often.
Now, remarkable. John Kimmel with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. And John, I would quite often tell trainers that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, but it sounds like those two apples couldn't be any further away from the tree. Did your sons ever think about getting involved with you on the horse racing side, or was it always about something else for them?
Well, you know, I think this is probably a dilemma that many trainers and the sons and daughters of trainers face, is that this is such a labor-intensive, time-consuming business that the kids of this new generation, I think, don't want to be committed to that kind of work schedule. And that not being home for many of their sporting events and things that you would have hoped to do, because you're tied up with most racing on the weekends and on trips and traveling, and that you don't get to spend as much time with your kids as you wanted to. So it kind of robs a little bit of that association with your children. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, they look at, and do they want to emulate the same kind of style in their lives. And I think both of them chose to, you know, a different path.
Yeah, well, that's that happens a lot in racing families. It's one way or the other. They either love the sport and can't get enough of it and go into it, or they don't want anything to do with it.
It's true. The older boy, I used to take him to the sales, and his main interest was in reading the catalogs and looking at the pedigrees and the horses at the sales. He'll probably be the only one that can afford one. But,
yeah, you got to be nice to him. He could be a big client. Sounds like he's got plenty of dough to play with.
Yeah, maybe some of those associates over there get them interested in this business, because they play with figures that are astronomical.
John, how many times did you watch the replay of Bar of Gold's victory when you were home with the family?
Oh, I played it probably a dozen times just with the family, and when we had Thanksgiving dinner and people were over, and, you know, it was fun. They actually, if you go to the YouTube, there's there's the call by Trevor Denman, and then there's the call by Kalmus. It's actually has an aerial view of the start, so it was kind of fun to look at them and watch the race from two different perspectives. So yeah, I've watched it a number of times, and it still gives me a smile watching the finish. I sure Josie Carroll doesn't feel the same way. But,
I think she's
a nice lady, and you know it's funny. That race over in Presque Isle might be the earmarked prep race for this event. And, you know, so many of the horses that have run well or won this race have been running in that Presque Isle race. It's kind of hard to imagine how many have come out of there that fared well in this race.
Yeah, that race has really, really turned into a Breeders' Cup prep, so to speak. But, yeah, you know, I always love to tell the story about Vincent Timpany. I don't know if you knew Vince or not, but he won the first Breeders' Cup Classic, and every time you'd go to his house, that film played on a loop on his television set. It was on all day, every day, and he never got over that race. It was just the his pride and joy, and you could not walk in his house and you'd see that TV and there was Wild again running around in a circle.
Yeah, that was a big mutual too, that guy, and I think he supported it. Did he have to supplement to the race too?
Yeah, it's possible. It was the first one, so I don't know how all of that worked, but yeah, they bet pretty good. That was crazy. Now I have another marketing tip for you. I think you need to get your son a beautiful winter circle photo for his office so that when people come in, they'll say, what's that?
That's,
right?
That's a very good idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit of subliminal advertising
right,
there.
Right, right. Yeah. Conversation piece.
Absolutely. What a moment and what a career it has been for trainer John Kimmel. He is our special guest tonight on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We are going to continue this visit with John in the second half of the show. We'll look back on some of his other memorable moments he's had in this storied career, and we'll tell you a little bit more about growing up around horses. That's where John got his start in New Jersey. We'll tell you more about that, too. That's all ahead. Second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Stay with us on HRN. Make plans now to attend the Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mix Sale, Tuesday, December 5th in Timonium, Maryland. The sale will be followed by a special Horses of Racing Age supplement, and nominations are now being accepted for the 2018 Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, being held at Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, Florida on March 28th. You can nominate to this premier two-year-old in training sale by visiting FasigTipton.com. That's FasigTipton.com. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
Attention horsemen, the 2017 Iowa Stallion Auction takes place December 2nd through the 9th, with all monies raised used to fund three stakes races, which had total purses of nearly $219,000 this year. The auction is the only stallion auction where the donator of the stallion season is eligible to receive a $5,000 per race bonus. All foals born in 2019, regardless of what state they're foaled in, are eligible to nominate. Make your stallion donation now at iowathoroughbred.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, what a finish to the classic.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Unique Fellas lost the lead as they come to the top of the stretch. Princess Karen and Amiz Mesa. These two now turn for home. Unique Bella has given way. Here's Bar of Gold on the far outside, and Karina Mia splitting horses too. Amiz Mesa to catch. Bar of Gold attacks outside. Karina Mia attacks on the rail. These three coming down to the line of the filly and mare sprint, and it is very close. It looked like Bar of Gold has defeated Amiz Mesa on the wire. Karina Mia was third in the final time of 1 minute 22.63 seconds.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna and Jude Feld back with you in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, visiting with trainer John Kimmel, who recorded that first Breeders' Cup victory of his career with Bar of Gold, who took the filly and mare sprint. Larry Colmus had the call for you coming out of the commercial break. Don't forget that if you missed any portion of this show, all you have to do is head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast of this program and all of our shows is available for you to listen to at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. John, pretty impressive. I know you said in the first half of the show that you've watched the race several times, but now you've got a chance to listen to that stretch call, and I know how special that moment was for you. And what it was like watching her storm through the stretch. She becomes just the third New York bred ever to win a Breeders' Cup race, joining Day at the Spa and London Bridge. And man, you think back on everything you've accomplished. You've come a long way since the days of Bodacious Tatas.
There's an intro.
In the Breeders' Cup races. I was second in the juvenile with Chief Seattle. And I was third in the Classic with Premium Tap. And I've only started maybe seven or eight horses in total in Breeders' Cup races. But, you know, it certainly is. It was great. It was a great accomplishment. And, you know, just to have notched one is really important. And maybe it might springboard a little new business in this stable operation of mine, because it's gotten to be, you know, too few people holding too many of the cards, and I don't think it's good for the business. When I was the leading trainer and I've won seven training titles in New York, it was capped at 44 horses, and there are plenty of trainers here that are qualified to get the job done, but until the owners kind of change their perspective that only one or two guys know how to do it, it's not going to change, because I don't think they're ever going to legislate a cap on stall space anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, and just for the record, by the way, people who think I might have been lewd with that comment about Bodacious Tatas, that was a horse that John trained when he won the Grade 2 Molly Pitcher in 1989, Bodacious Tatas, and to see where he is today, it's pretty special. John, would you ever stop and think back that far and ask yourself, you know, wow, has this all really happened to me?
You know, I was just kind of looking in the Blood Horse. They did an article on me in the Blood Horse, and I didn't even know, because I don't get the magazine sent. And so I just went John Kimmel, Blood Horse, and, you know, there was over 10 pages of stuff and then Blood Horse, and I said, wow, it goes back a long time. You know, when you think about it, to have been in this business for over 37 years, both as a veterinarian and as a trainer, and there's been a lot of good memories, a lot of heartaches, and in general, it's 37 years that have gone by extremely fast. But I still think we got some good ones in the tank, because I think my level of knowledge and understanding based on the past experiences is only helpful in the way I handle these horses today.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you can't find anywhere else. I mean, in racing, learn by doing is the number one thing, I believe. And, you know, trainers know themselves when they first start out, you know, whether it comes easy or comes hard right away, they're much better the older they get. I mean, they're really, you know, the fine wine comparison is absolutely true with trainers. I mean, you learn so much every day, and you get better and better at your craft. And I think a lot of times that gets lost. Everybody wants the new, young, up-and-coming trainer. And then, you know, the guys that really know how to train horses have to struggle for clients.
Well, that's a very true statement. And, you know, even some of the guys that have been around and done it before are, you know, sitting there with empty stalls and looking to be able to, you know, put some quality horses in the barn, because really that's what it's all about. It's, you know, everybody can have a bunch of claimers, but it's the guys that know how to select, develop, and take those horses from their either their yearling or two-year-old purchases and develop them into quality horses that are not just flashes in the pan, but are around for, you know, 2 and 3 year racing careers. To me, that's the hallmark of somebody that really knows what they're doing.
Yeah, a lot of times nowadays horses just have meets, and then they disappear.
They have one good race, and you know that's the end of it. But you know, I got to say that some of my better horses that were around for, you know, 3 or 4 good seasons of racing, and it's I think that's a little bit of an accolade that, you know, when they needed a break, they got a break. And sometimes when they didn't, it was just, look, these horses in the old days, they used to have, you know, a couple months off every winter, and they came back fresh and developed for the next season and would always move forward. And I think that's a strategy that I think would work today, and I employ it all the time.
Yeah, John, if you were going to describe your training philosophy, how would you do it?
Well, you know, I think nobody can make a superstar out of an average horse. So it all comes down to what you have to work with. And I would say when I was at the top of the game, I had a fairly good client base that would not only send me horses, but would support me in the marketplace. And I've been pretty successful for a guy that doesn't spend, you know, tremendous sums of money. I think at my last count, I had 10 or 11 grade one winners that have been purchased out of the marketplace. And, you know, it starts with that. You know, you have a nice horse to work with, and then you provide the pathway, and each horse is a little bit different than another one. For example, take a horse like Premium Tap, which is probably the number one leading horse that I've trained as far as money earned. Here's a horse I bought for $60,000 at the two-year-old in training sale. And so he goes on and he wins like his second start as a two-year-old, and we get offered $650,000 for the horse. You would think you would have jumped on that right away, but the people involved, there's three guys. I said, you know, he looks like he's going to be a nice older horse, and maybe we have a really good three-year-old. And so we all said, nah, we're not going to do it. So we didn't do it. We bring him down to Florida for his three-year-old career. Things go down the tube. He ends up bruised cannon bones, goes to the farm. He doesn't surface for another 9 months. So, oh, boy, I guess we should have sold that one for $650. So he comes back in his four-year-old career, and you know, he runs a big race in a money-one allowance race and beats Sun King, and comes back, runs a fairly good race in the Whitney. And in that race in the Whitney, he had missed a couple weeks of training, so he got beat about 5 lengths and had uninterrupted training from the Whitney to the Woodward. And, you know, he wins the Woodward at a pays $60 in the Woodward. He has a horrible race in the Turfway Classic, but runs third in the Breeders' Cup to Invasor and Bernardini at like 28-1 and 30. I don't even remember. It was a big price, and the guys coughed up a couple hundred grand to run in there. And then he comes back 3 weeks later and runs a dominating, I think it was like 13, 14 lengths performance in the Clark after shipping back and forth in a van. And we get calls from Sheikh Mo and King Abdullah Aziz representative, and I sell the horse to the King of Saudi Arabia for $5.7 million.
Wow.
So that's like, how things can change in this business as a four-year-old. So then it becomes a funny story. So the manager representing the King says, if we buy this horse, will you come run him in our race in Saudi Arabia? I said, you tell the King if he buys a horse for $5.7 million, I'll run him wherever he wants, anywhere in the world. So anyway, we shipped the horse over this extravagant plans to fly the horse from his base at Gulfstream to JFK. He stays at the barn at Belmont, and then he flies from here to Germany to Saudi Arabia, and he gets there like on a Tuesday. The race is Friday night. I fly over with DeSormo. We get there, watch him train on Thursday. Friday night's the race. He hasn't now run since Thanksgiving weekend in the Clark at a mile and an eighth that race was. He's never run further than a mile and a quarter. This race, a mile and a half against a field of like 20. So we're walking up there, and the manager's on the phone with the King, and he says, the King says he doesn't want to be embarrassed. You should scratch your horse if he's not going to win. What? I said, we just spent like $50,000 to set him, $20,000 for me and the jock. And I mean, he probably put $100,000. The purse is only $35,000 for the race. I'm going, what? So anyway, so we're walking up there. I said, I don't even know who he's running against. But look, he's doing really good. We're not stopping now. We're running. And God, he circled the field. I said, who the heck could be in Saudi Arabia? So he circled the field, threw off, and won for fun. And I said, maybe that wasn't so smart. I'm, you know, half a Jew in me. I said, oh, my God, the next thing I know, if he doesn't run any good, I might never leave Saudi Arabia. So anyway, it ended up great. I got to meet the King. The King was happy. And we followed that up with the second place finish in the Dubai World Cup to Invesaur about a month later. And at that point, they were going to send the horse back to this country, but he decided to keep him there, and he never really did much after that.
John Kimmel, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. John, I want to know more about that flight with DeSormo. That had to be a fun flight, too.
The flight home?
Any stories you can tell on the radio?
Well, you know, we basically, it's funny, when you're over Saudi Arabia airspace, you're not allowed to drink any alcohol. So as soon as they said we're clear, I think Aaron Grider was on the flight with DeSormo and me, and that was the end of the Dom Perignon by the time we cleared European airspace. So we had a great time, and we also had a great time going to the World Cup. It was the last year of racing at Mad El Sheba, and it was a very nice experience to go race over there as well.
You talked earlier about your clients and how important it is to have good clients. Mr. Broman, it was his first Breeders' Cup win, too, I believe. Talk about that for a minute.
Well, Mr. Broman and his wife, Mary, have been and have basically become the premier breeders of New York breeds. He started with a little farm that he bought off a guy, and it's kind of strange. You're kind of driving up through the Adirondacks north of Saratoga, and you see this white picket fence, and you know, what is this thing doing in the middle? And he's basically created this incredibly nice thoroughbred breeding farm right in the middle of the Adirondacks. He raises offspring bred to the best stallions in Kentucky, Medagliadoros. He had Stormcats. He's had plenty of Bernardinis, and just up and down the line, he's been breeding these New York mares to these stallions in Kentucky and raising probably the best bred New York breds that anyone breeds. And he folds them out there. They get to the weaning stages, and then they're shipped to Florida, where they finish off the rest of their careers. And from the time they're short weanlings right up through their start of their two-year-old careers.
Yeah, they do a tremendous job. And to win a race like the Breeders' Cup for people like that that have been so supportive, I can imagine that has to mean even more, doesn't it?
Oh, he's a great guy. He's a typical good guy, blue-collar guy that came up the hard way, and he made his money in the construction and business and, like, road preparation and stuff for highways. And, you know, he's just a really nice guy. He doesn't get involved with telling you what to do. He's got total confidence in what you're telling him, and he's basically along for the ride and enjoys it immensely. And, you know, as he's getting on in age, it was nice for him to have an experience in a moment like that, because they're hard to come by, and sometimes people never get to come by them.
John, I loved your premium tap story. So if you were putting a resume tape together and somebody said, okay, John, what would you consider to be your greatest training feat? What would it be?
I think that's a race. This goes back now to the Gopher Wand. It was the opening race when you go back to Saratoga. And I had two horses in it. I had a horse named Hidden Lake, and I had a horse for Robert Clay and Tracy Farmer that had come to me. And I had a horse named Flat Fleet Feet that was belonged to my father. And she was a pretty sharp two-year-old, but was limited in her distances. And kind of at the last moment, I decided to, you know, let's see what she can do. And Mike Smith was on Flat Fleet Feet, and Migliore was riding Hidden Lake. And I had on my left my father, and on the right I had Robert Clay. And they came to the top of the stretch, drew away from the field. Hidden Lake looked like she was going to get beat. She was down on the inside. Flat Fleet Feet stuck her head, got a neck in front, and Mig went left-handed and got up and beats her ahead. So I got these two guys next to me. I didn't know who to root for. I had my dad, and I had Robert Clay. So you're kind of standing there. And one's disappointed, one's elated. And it just shows you how the wave of emotions can change in an instant. We look up at the top of the stretch, and Migliore jumps off in like something's not right, didn't pull up well. So obviously Robert Clay's elation just deflated to a flat balloon. So I go out on the racetrack, run down over there to where the mile pole is. I look at the horse, and I didn't see any bag of marbles or anything that looked really bad. So I said, she's okay, don't put her on the van. We walked back to the winner's circle, and it's the only grade one winning picture you'll see with everybody standing on the ground, including the jockey. He never got back up on her. So it turned out she had a suspensory strain in the body of her suspensory. And basically, I had a lot of therapy I did with her in this whirlpool that she used to jump in there and be in that ice whirlpool every day, and walked her for a couple of weeks, jogged her for like a month, and started training her and getting more serious with her. And Robert Clay wanted to run her in the Spinster, which was the first week of October at Keeneland. I said, you know, I think we need another work. And I wanted to run her in the Hempstead here at Belmont. And that was a week later, and allowed me to get another pretty good prep into her prior to it. And she ran in that race and won that off no other racing between mid-July and the second week of October. And won that in a fantastic race. And I think she ran like 115 by her number and ran like a mile and an eighth and 146 and change. It was a super great race, and beat Jewel Princess and twice the Vice. And to me, that was a very accomplished training feat, to be able to run against the top horses. Jewel Princess had won the Breeders' Cup the year before, and for her to do that off that injury and that length of time at a mile and an eighth, I thought that was pretty sharp.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Gives you chills when you think about it.
Yeah, and those two fillies, too, Flat Fleet Feet who Tom Durkin always used to say very slowly when he would call the race because he would get tripped up.
I was admiring how John just says it like nothing, but yeah. he said it a lot more times than Tom Durkin, I'm sure.
Durkin had a whole string of F words. He said that's flat, fleet, feet in front in the final furlong.
Tom was brilliant with that name. And, of course, Hidden Lake is a filly that I'm never going to forget either. And, you know, there's another one that you trained, John, that I'm sure was very special to you, and she was special to me as I was watching racing growing up in the Northeast, and that was Twist of Fleet, because she always seemed to show up. She was so brilliant in her races, and she was just as honest as they come. Tell me about her.
She was one of my two-year-old purchases. We bought her at the Fassig Tipton. Your sponsor had a sale down there at Calder at the time, and I bought her off a guy named Jerry Bailey, and she was by a horse named Afleet, and Afleet being by Mr. Prospector, who has been to me when I was a kid growing up. I was around him and, you know, just thought he was like a most special horse. And just a little aside, when he was retired, I had asked my dad, I said, you know, why don't you buy this share in this horse? It's Mr. Kroll is syndicating him through Savin Stable. They want $50,000. You could pay it in three allotments over 3 years. He said, son, that horse is only a sprinter and never going to be any kind of stallion. okay. So anyway, we all know what that story turned out to be. I said, what a great stallion and influence in the thoroughbred business that he's been. So I always had looked at some of his sons, and Afleet was one of them. And I had Afleet's only two grade one winners in North America with both Flat Fleet Feed and Twist of Fleet. So Twist of Fleet had won her first three races, maybe first four, and she went into the test stake as an undefeated filly. And Jerry Bailey was riding her, and I think she had a little chip in a hind ankle that gave her most of the winter off, and she come back and she won. And here was the day of the test, and it was a rainy, wet, nasty day, and I'm scratching my head, you know, just had one surgery. Is this the right thing to do? After all that contemplating, I said, well, I guess we'll run because she's ready and she's doing well. And here she is. She looks like turning for home. She's going to win for fun. And there's a big puddle down on the inside, and she jumps the puddle with Bailey on board and was able to regain her momentum. And that was my first grade one win. It was a real special moment for me and people involved with the horse.
Yeah, that's got to be a scary feeling, huh, when that happens, something unforeseen like that?
Oh, yeah, she's done that before. She did it also when she won the Top Flight, and it wasn't a wet track. If you run out of the chute at Aqueduct, there's a rail there that kind of extends from where the bend is so that horses, you know, don't make a left-hand turn. Well, she tried to make a left-hand turn, and I thought she broke down, and everybody was kind of upset, and she still came on and won the Top Flight there and beat a filly named Chaposa Springs. You probably know that name.
Sure.
But anyway, yeah, many things can happen that you don't expect. Just ask Safely Kept's race and that unbelievable shadow jumping event when DeJour jumps it. She had the race won, and he jumps the shadow, and here comes Safely Kept, regains the lead, and wins the race. It was like, how did that happen?
He's trainer John Kimmel. He's our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fassig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, only about 2 or 3 minutes left before we have to wrap things up. You talked earlier about some of the attributes that make a trainer successful. As you were growing up and you were just getting started in the game, were there specific trainers or maybe one trainer individual that you looked up to and said, if someday I can be as good as them, I'll be doing things the right way?
Well, I was around, Alan Jerkins, and he was probably the guy that seemed to have a little different take on some things. So whenever I had a little question, I was getting on the pony and he'd be sitting on that pony somewhere on the racetrack, and I go, hey, Alan, what do you think? And he always had a very horseman-like perspective that I had a real understanding of why that perspective was. And if I had anyone that I would say really I looked up to, it was Alan Jerkins.
Yeah, nobody better, really. Unbelievable help to a lot of trainers over the years.
Yeah, good man. John, before we let you go, I always like to wrap things up by letting listeners know a little something about trainers that they might not ordinarily get to know. So we're going to play a little game here. I'm going to ask you five quick questions. It's five fast facts to know about John Kimmel. And you just answer them real quick, and we'll be good to go. You ready?
Go ahead.
All right, so we'll start real simple. Is it chocolate or vanilla for you?
Vanilla.
All right. Your favorite type of food?
Fish.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
All right. Your favorite vacation destination? You can go anywhere in the world.
Utah, skiing. No, heli skiing in British Columbia.
Ooh, that's a good one. All right. And I'll put this one on a tee for you. Your favorite musical artist would be?
Bruce Springsteen.
Ooh. I thought you were going to pick your son.
I thought you were going to pick Saudi Arabia for your favorite destination.
Yeah.
So much fun. John, what's the future hold here? About 1 minute left. Take us through what folks can expect this coming year from John Kimmel.
Well, you know, I kind of have to get on my horse and kind of promote the business a little bit. And I think getting out there and kind of using this particular race to bring in some new clients or some old clients that have kind of gone in other directions. And you see, because it's all about, you know, what you get to work with. And if you don't have horses to work with, then it doesn't matter if, like a football coach, if you're the best coach in the world and you don't have good players, it doesn't matter how good a coach you are.
Well said.
So that really is my my focus. I like working the two-year-old sales. I've done very well in the past, and hopefully can spur some interest by people that are looking to be well-represented, because I see so many people misrepresented out there that they're done before they get started. And I think with my veterinary background and my ability to evaluate young horses, and none of them are perfect, so there's some things you can accept and deal with, and I think many times they get removed from the population of prospective purchases where they shouldn't be, because plenty of horses running around there, most of them have some issues somewhere along the line.
Well, he's John Kimmel. He's our special guest here on Trainer Talk. John, appreciate the visit, my friend. Thank you so much for being here, and all the best. We'll look forward to catching up with you soon.
Okay, guys. It was fun. Thanks so much.
All right. Good stuff. John Kimmel with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. That's about going to do it for us here tonight. Thank you for being with us. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.